Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor the Communication Doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do.
Brilliant. Narrative, of course. Hi, this is Real Stories, and I'm your host, Teddy the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have James Pogson. And James Pogson is a storyteller, a narrative storyteller. You got it right. So hello, James. Tell us a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about your storytelling and your narrative storytelling, and what's that about, please?
Well, everybody knows stories. Mm. We're all raised on stories. But I look at narrative being the telling of the stories. Mm, mm. It's a bit like, you know, you could tell a joke.
Yeah.
Somebody else could tell the same joke, but I haven't told it the way you've told it.
Mm, mm.
So, you know, the timing could be off. The voice might not get it right or whatever. So for me, it's about the telling of the story, which is the narrative.
And when did this begin? When did you find this love for stories? Is it when you were a child? When did you discover this love for stories and then this love for writing? When did all that start for you?
Oh, definitely as a child. Mm. I'd say it comes from my parents because everything's an oral tradition.
Yeah.
So we were told stories, my two older brothers and I were told stories about back home. Both my parents are from the island of St. Kitts, but they didn't meet each other until they came here to England.
Oh, beautiful.
So we heard all about their upbringing and what they used to do back home and all the, you know, all the tales, all the proverbs. So I very much latched on to stories.
Brilliant.
And believe it or not, I was an extremely shy child.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why you got lost in the books? Because of your shyness a little bit?
Yeah, the books, the stories. And I developed a love of reading first.
Mm.
And then writing my own stories. Mm. And I was that child at school whose story would always get read out by the teacher.
Mm. Mm.
And the kids would moan and go, oh, not James's again. And I found it hugely embarrassing.
Yeah. God, no, I can imagine that. It's sometimes like when you're put on the spot as a child, that's quite intense at times. But I want to dial back because I want you to create me a picture of what it was like when you were a child. And you read, just pick one of your favourite books that you've ever read when you were young. And just tell me what that felt like.
You know, here's a strange thing. I can only go far back as, I remember reading Stick of the Dump.
Oh.
Right? So, but in terms of books in the house, there was the Bible and the Encyclopedia of Useful Facts. that was it, you know, really. And, you know, there were newspapers, tabloid newspapers. We didn't have broadsheets in our house.
I love the idea of the encyclopedic book because actually it's so funny. It reminds me of my sister, actually, because she used to like reading the medical book. She was lost in it, and I never understood her fascination with it. But as she got older, it made sense. So it is funny, isn't it, what you are drawn to and what you read when you're young. So you just loved words, I guess, with the encyclopedia.
It was a case of, because those are the only books in the house. It was, you know, typical West Indian parents. It's like, education is the key, knowledge is power. So it's like, Encyclopedia of Useful Facts. Read it, go read your book. Read it. And it's like, so you had a toss up between, do I read the Encyclopedia of Useful Facts or the Bible? And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to Sunday school. Oh.
Got it. Hilarious, isn't it? The Bible.
Yeah. I read the Encyclopedia of Useful Facts. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, the Bible got some good stories, though, I must say. Some good
stories. but when your parents are kind of preaching to you every day anyway.
You know what? It's sometimes quite daunting. You know, you look at the size of the words of the Bible because it's so small, isn't it? And it's almost quite daunting. It could get quite scary. Oh, my God, what do I sit? Do I sit and read that? Because it's so intense, isn't it? You know?
We had a big Bible, a big colour Bible. And it's like, I remember there's a picture, you know, when Jesus is 40 days and 40 nights where he's being tempted by the devil.
Yes.
It's a big picture and you got this red devil. And I remember being young and it used to frighten me. My brothers used to go, watch. And I'm like, oh, it's a devil. It's the devil. Oh. It's like, oh, no.
No, that's the thing. But you know what? On that note of looking back at your childhood, what is one of your fondest memories as a child?
Well, I think it was when I was 4 years old. Mm. My mum took me to St. Kitts because it had been the first time she'd been back.
Yeah.
And I always say to people, she was kind of forced to take me because my two older brothers were already at school. Mm. Mm. I'm 4 years old. And my mum's planning to go for 6 weeks. So she thought, can't let my husband look after the three boys. I've got to take one with me. So I went, and it was the first time I'd ever met my mum's mum.
Oh, wow.
And my dad's mum.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't believe, because obviously my mum had spoken about her mum. Mm, mm. But because I'd never seen her, I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
So until I saw my grandmother, it blew my mind that my mum had a mum. I was like, but your mum, how have you got a mum?
That's beautiful. How old were you at the time?
I was four.
You were four,
I was four, yeah. And my mum's maiden name is my first name.
Okay.
So we all, so my grandmother, everybody called her Granny James. And I was like, oh my God, it's amazing. My name's James and you're Granny James. Mm. And she was lovely. Really, we really got on and we played a lot together. But the thing that struck me the most, she told my mum what to do and my mum did it. And I was like, wow, because not even my dad could tell my mum what to do.
Yeah.
You know, not even my mum's older sisters and brothers could tell her what to do. But here I was in St. Kitts meeting my mum's mum who could tell her what to do.
No, that's quite amazing, actually, isn't it? When you discover that as a young person, especially when you haven't grown up with your grandparents around,
yeah,
it's almost like a revelation. But how did you find it? Did you go to St. Kitts regularly after that, or was that that's the first time? So after, did you visit St. Kitts regularly?
Well, it took me 19 years for my next visit.
Oh really? Oh wow! Oh wow! Yeah. Wow!
Now altogether, now I've been 7 times.
Oh wow, that's good.
I've been a couple of times on my own. Mm. Mm. The last time I went, I travelled with my mum and dad. But my dad was in an urn because it's my dad's ashes.
Yeah.
So, like with most West Indian families, you don't go on family holidays. Mm. Not in my generation, and he didn't go on family holidays. So it was either my dad was going to St. Kitts on his own, or my mum was going to St. Kitts or to visit her aunt in Bermuda or her sister in America. But we never went anywhere as a family. We never even walked to church together as a family.
You know what? Was there kind of some kind of conspiracy or behind that, or some kind of security consciousness behind that? What do you think is behind that? Because I know with my family, my dad would never travel with my mum because he's always said, we're such a big family that we can't travel together. So if we were going to Jamaica, it'd be my mum and me and my two of my sisters, or if it was my dad, he'd go with my other sisters because they're a big family. But we'd always split up because he'd say, in terms of we don't want to all travel together in case we lose or if anyone has an accident. Okay. And I thought he was ultra security conscious. That was my father. But what was it with you? Because I always think, what is it? Why people don't have those kind of togetherness or those, what goes on behind the scenes? Why is it that West Indians do that? Why do you think?
I think from our point of view, it was economic, to be honest. Let's keep it real. And yeah. Also, I mean, as much as my parents were from the same island, they were from different parts of the island.
Yeah.
So, whenever I went with my mum, I stayed with her family.
Okay.
And everyone would shout out James because I look like my mum and my mum is a James. So you go, James. So I'm thinking, wow, everybody knows my name. But I weren't referring to my first name. So they come up to me and say, you're a James, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah. And they go, whose child are you? And I tell them, and I said, so what's your name? And I said, my name's James. And they go, well, yeah, we know you're James, but what's your name? And I'm like, no, that's my name is James. Right? So, and then when I go to my dad's village, it's, you're a fox, aren't you? Yeah, okay. And I'm thinking, weird. So, because everyone was saying, yeah, you look like your dad.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, I think I look like my mum. In my mum's village, yeah, you look like your mum. Of course. I'm like, yeah, you know. And even here in England, I've gone shopping and I've seen elders and they stopped me and said, you're James, aren't you? Because James is unknown. We're known for our big eyes and our teeth. And he goes, you're James, aren't you? Yeah. So it's just, and now with the beard, especially it's gone grey now, I look like my uncle who passed away a few years back.
So
and it's like, Theodore. And I'm like, no. Yeah, you look like Theodore. Like, yeah, he's my uncle. And so yeah.
So it's
a true James.
It's interesting you said it's demographic as well, do you know what I mean, in terms of, you know, what's going on there on the level with regards to families and everything else and moving together. But what was it like kind of growing up in Birmingham? Did you grow up in a very black area? What was it like where you were growing up and going to school?
Well, you call it a multicultural area. I mean, the neighbours to our left were Asian, to our right were white, but there were many Caribbean families on our road.
Yeah, oh, that's nice. That is nice.
Our junior school was multicultural. Because literally, our junior school was literally round the corner. So you walk around the corner and you're in a classroom with white kids, black kids, Asian kids. I don't think I had any black, no, in fact, no, I did not have any black teachers at primary school or junior school. There were a couple of Asian teachers in the school, but they never taught me.
Yeah. But that's interesting, isn't it, really? And I feel, I used to go to Burnham a lot, we visit family when I was young, and I used to love the fact that my aunties and uncles were just round the corner from each other. Everybody lived on like the next road or the road, and that was really special for me because growing up I didn't experience that. But I just feel it's lovely when you have those communities and people have come together, and the West Indians are all within that community, and you know, the food and the culture is really strong. That's always my experience of Birmingham when I go down that, the real strong culture, a real connection with the Caribbean kind of culture and society and the food. And I kind of feel they eat, for my family, they eat like they still do in Jamaica, as well, the yam and the banana, the hot food. Yeah. And it's so funny because growing up, I didn't really experience that as much. So it was always really lovely. It was almost like a real place of going home for me for that. So I do have those fond memories of that. So it's really interesting when you talk about Birmingham. When I met you, James, I had that instant connection because I thought, oh my God, he's a Brummie. You know, you kind of think, yeah, he's a Brummie.
Born and bred.
There's that thing. But I'm going to fast forward to that because you paint a beautiful picture of your childhood. And as we fast forward, I want to ask you from a racist kind of perspective, what kind of challenges you experienced as a black man moving forward, as you got a little bit older, growing up in Birmingham, coming from the community you did?
Yeah. Well, you get that. Well, for me, I still get it. Which is, do you have a criminal record? And of course I don't. Mm. Followed up by, are you sure you don't have a criminal record? And, you know, have you sold drugs? And it's like, and you must smoke weed, obviously, because you're a black man. Now, I've never smoked anything, and I repeat, anything, not even a cigarette.
You know what? So just, but give us a context of that. So was it that you were stopped in the car? Can you give us a story? Just pick one of those experiences and tell us a story.
Well, it's just literally when I was at college. I remember when I was at college and I'm about 17, 18.
Yeah.
So you're getting fellow students saying, yeah, can I buy some weed off you? And I'm like, oh, you mean as in weeds, as in grass? As in garden. And they go, no, you, yeah, that was me. And they go, no, you know, like ganja and stuff. And I'm like, what makes you think I'm doing that? Because you're Jamaican. I'm like, what makes you think I'm Jamaican? Because you're black. And I'm like, hold on. I said, first of all, I said, you've heard of the West Indies? Because back then we called it the West Indies as opposed to the Caribbean.
Yeah, yeah.
Said, yeah, and I said, you know, there's more than one island.
Mm.
It's not just Jamaica. You know, there are other islands. And I says, oh, you know, I says, well, I'm not Jamaican and I don't smoke anything. I can't believe you don't smoke because you're black. I says, what? And I says, well, I can believe you're not intelligent because you're white.
Oh.
And they'd get offended. Can you imagine that? Yeah. They would get offended.
I love that. I love that. You have to stick up for yourself, especially when you're with words and throw it out because it's all these assumptions that are made about you. But then you know what? I always find it's really lovely to speak to you today because I want to go a little bit deeper because it is interesting that you're using comedy or comedy is your aspect or your way of kind of a, your, the way of you work and you're a writer and you're good with words and so forth and so forth. But I always find, I feel that some black men have gone through so much in terms of the racism. We all have, but I do feel black men get it harder. Like that's my opinion. And no one really ever talks about it in depth. And you've been really, really talking so openly about the racism that you've experienced. But what about the pain beneath that? How do you deal with that? How do you kind of pick yourself up and keep going and going and going? Can you just explain that to me? Where do you find that strength? Because you're hit from all different directions. But how do you find this strength to keep going?
The resilience comes from my parents. Because, you know, very early on, they said to me and my brothers, they says, look, even though we kept saying to you, you're English and you're British, the world is going to see you as black. And because we were always very tall for our height, it says there are going to be people looking at you thinking that you're a black man as opposed to a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy.
Yes.
So you've got to represent us. And what they said to us very early on, I think they said this when I was still at junior school. And they said, your job, and I actually said the word job, your job is to go to school. Our job is to go to work. So from an early, very early age, my mindset was, well, this is my vocation. And they said, you got to deal with it because this country is racist. Even though they saw it as a mother country, they said, how are you going to be treated? And we had a lot of humor in our house. My mom, very, very wicked sense of humor. My dad, less so. But my dad was king of the one-liners, but not humorous one-liners.
Yeah.
But the resilience was taught in us, you know. Most kids who have West Indian parents have that resilience. Mm-hmm. Whereas your parents spoke at you rather than having conversations with you. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe PSIC now, they'd call them pep talks. But it was literally, do this, do that, do this, do that. But the one thing they did say to me and my brothers is, if you get any problems with any of your teachers or anyone picking on you, what they said is, any kid hits you, hit them back. Mm-hmm. Don't hit them first. Hit them back. If the teachers are giving you any grief, don't back chat to the teachers. Tell us, we'll deal with the teachers. But at the same time, if you're the instigator of the problems, we're going to deal with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I always knew I had, no matter what oppression there was, and it, you know, we knew that our parents had our back. Having said that, we knew as well, you couldn't say to your mom, oh, mom, dad, a man on the street called me the N-word, or the kid in the playground called me the N-word, because you knew your parents were going through their racist grief in the factory, because both my parents worked in factories. You know, so, and then, you know, my mom came to this country when she was 17. Yeah. So my mom has no written, both my parents have no written qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
I wholeheartedly believe that education is the key. Listen to your teachers. And, you know, basically listen to your white teachers. However, if you get into an argument with them, tell us, we'll deal with it.
Yeah. Now that's so important, isn't it, really? And that's so important to know that you've got your back. And it's interesting, you did generalize a little bit and saying all West Indian parents, we're generally quite resilient as people. And I feel that's yes in some ways with a lot of people, but there are the odd family and people that have really suffered, do you know, with regards to mental health and everything else.
Yeah.
And because some people are totally, yes, they are resilient as people because, you know, my parents came over, I think they were about 18, 19, that sort of age when they came to this country. And I just think, wow, you know, what an ambition to want more for yourself to do that 18 and to take that leap. And then to go through everything they went through, then they had to be so resilient. But nowadays, you know, you kind of, I notice people, especially some men, in regards to mental health, there's a lot of men, black men, that are in these institutions. There's a high rate, statistically. And then for me, I just feel some people are diagnosed when they're not diagnosed with something they're not meant to be diagnosed with. So there's lots of these different kind of stigmas and impacts. So what do you think about that as a black man? Have you ever thought about that? And have you ever known anybody close to you that's been affected in that way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, members of my family. But also, I mean, the discussions I've been having with black men over lockdown.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially of my generation, because we're all like middle-aged men now.
Yeah.
In our 50s and 60s. And I was talking to a few of them about the term midlife crisis.
Yeah.
And I said, when we were growing up, the only people that you heard having a midlife crisis were white men.
Yeah.
White middle-class men. Because what you'd hear is, it's like, oh, you know, he's trading in the family saloon for a Porsche. He's wearing leather trousers and maybe got a motorbike. And he's got a leggy blonde girlfriend because he's left his wife for 30, 40 years. And that don't sound like any black man I know.
That's definitely a...
So even if you look at it from the definition of what we saw as a mental breakdown or a midlife crisis, it was referring to white people. Because black people just go crazy, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, and even fast forward now, you got the future King of England, Prince William, talking about mental health.
Yeah.
But who gets sectioned like nobody's business for decades? Us.
Yes. Exactly.
So even when we're watching him, I'm looking at a young white man who's going to be the future King of England, a privileged white man, talking about mental health. And it's like, because he's a white guy, oh, let's talk about mental health now. What about all the black men and women who have been sectioned?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they just went crazy and they were aggressive. But all of a sudden, from you know, mental health now is a white agenda, isn't it? Or the perception.
It's so interesting. Yeah, and it really does get on my nerves. It's, you know, because I've worked a lot. I've done some work with regards to mental health. I used to teach a creative writing class. And it was just lovely, you know, when you kind of see the breakthrough. But what I also started to see was that some of these guys, I didn't think they were mentally ill when I was, you know, on a deeper level. And then, but some of them were given the drugs. And I do feel that within that industry, there's a lot of racism, you know. I think in terms of what you experience as a black man and as a black woman, sometimes when you're with diagnosis, well, there's proof with, what's his name, KB Coben. He talks a lot about, he's a psychologist, an African-American psychologist, and he talks a lot about the case studies and the way that black men are diagnosed or, you know, sectioned at a higher rate, at a quicker rate than white men in the mental health institutes. So it is a real problem, and it is something that I worry about in terms of, you know, that next generation to come, those the people to come. And as a black man, I feel I've got the opportunity to talk to you here. I thought it'd be nice to kind of have that conversation with you as well and to go deep and to see what that is about. Or, you know, have you ever been told in that way? Have you ever been called mad? Have you ever been, just for no reason, have you ever experienced anything like that? Because you're obviously very sane.
Thank you.
Has that ever happened to you? Because it really makes me think, it's quite interesting, and most people that I'm talking to and I'm starting to have these conversations with now, it's really interesting what's coming out, you know, in terms of how people are perceived and with regards to racism and the names that people have been called and what you've experienced yourself.
I mean, you get the situation, you know, when you're calling out racism as a black person and white people are like, James, where's this coming from? What are you talking about? Trying to make you doubt yourself.
Yeah.
Like, James, no, what are you saying? James, why are you being... I've been called aggressive by someone who was shouting at me, standing over me, shouting at me, and I wasn't shouting.
Yeah.
But I'm shouting and being aggressive about it. So they try and spin it around. I was like, James, why are you being like that? Why are you being so aggressive? I'm like, I just asked you a question. How is that aggression? Whereas they're allowed to shout and F from blind and everything, but that's okay. So it's, to me, it's, I think they've tried psychologically to wear black people down.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's almost like, well, there's women and there are black women. There are men and there are black men. And it's like, so, okay, so what are you trying to say then? You know, like, it's almost like they're treating us like we're a different species altogether. Which is why, which is why we need 15 officers to stop you, James, carrying it as the shopping bag because you look a bit aggressive. But the white guy who's holding the pistol, you know, we're just going to tell him to, you know, it's all right, son, calm down. And okay, you know, he might have killed a few people, but, you know, he's a good lad, really. But a black guy, you know, it's almost like potentially we look dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a white guy realistically has done something. Yeah, but there must be a reason why.
Mm-hmm. I know, and it's just disgusting. It really just upsets me. And I suppose during this whole George Floyd thing, everything has come up. People are speaking out. And just to kind of go to bring it to a lighter level, what do you think is amazing about being a black man?
What's amazing? That's a hard question to answer because...
I'm saying it on purpose. I'm using that language on purpose because I'm looking at the light. Because there's what's the good, what's passionate, what's great about being a black man? Tell me.
As my dad would say, why everything, you know, everything? Everything. The thing is, I don't even know, you know, I don't know what it's like to be a white guy or an Asian guy.
Yeah.
So all I can say from my point of view is the history, the culture. I've been told I've inherited my dad's walk. So it's the way I walk, the way I carry myself. And like I said, I can't compare myself to a white guy. I've never tried to because I'm me.
Mm.
And also, I think not every black man is the same.
Yeah.
I'm very different from my brothers.
Mm.
But I like the skin I'm in. I like who I am as a person. And the older I get, the more it's like, yeah, this is it. I'm not going to change.
Yeah, yeah. And then the reason I ask that question, and I use the word amazing on purpose, because it's almost like I want to celebrate, because we've been through so much. There is, you know, there is oppression, there is suppression. And as black people, as a black man, even like me talking to you about the stories and your challenges, there's a lot of negativity there, isn't there? You know? And I just feel like, if we as people can see what's amazing about us as a person, you know, then that's important. You know, what's amazing about James, what's amazing about being a black man, because sometimes it's like the world's against us. But I always say we maybe start 10 steps behind in society, especially living in this country. And in terms of the opportunities, or let's say the middle class white man, he has 10 steps ahead of us already. But we always catch up. And we always catch up and we always move forward, you know? So we're starting from here, but yet we always move forward and we always push up. And you just see black excellence on every aspect coming from everywhere, you know? We started to see that. And what's great about since this whole George Floyd thing, which was a horrible thing that happened, but what's been great is recently, you know, on TV, and also recently people have been speaking out. And recently, where that black excellence is being revealed. Now, do you think this is going to continue? How do you see this movement going from your...
Well, first of all, I'm going to start with, we were born excellent.
Yeah.
We just didn't realise it.
Yeah.
Right? We just didn't realise.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the older you get, the more you begin to know who you are.
Mm.
And find your own lane.
That's right.
Know who you are as a person. So don't watch everybody else. You might be thinking, oh, how come he or she's got this and that? They're not you. You know, understand who you are. Now, is this thing going to progress? I hope so. Because I'm fed up of people saying, oh, you know, these things got to take time. We got to develop these things slowly. You know, when the Europeans first embarked on the slave trade, they never said, let's take time. Imagine a boat. It's like, oh, you're on this ship. Oh, we can only take 500. Let's put 1,000 on. Let's do it now.
Yeah.
So they didn't take, you know, they spent 400 years not taking time. Mm. Now they're expecting us to take, these things take time. No, they don't. Listen, I've lived half my life already. I'm over half a century old. I ain't got time. It's now or never.
It's time to live it. It's time to enjoy it. It's time.
Absolutely.
Totally. And it's so important, isn't it, really, to kind of live that life now and to appreciate you for you. So what would you say now, like growing up, what would you say to your younger self if you could now?
I'd say, James, it's going to be okay. You really are a storyteller. Stay in that lane. Yeah. Don't shift. You got it.
Brilliant.
And P.S., you're going to lose your hair.
Oh, dear. And you've got to celebrate that as well now, James, haven't you? You've got to celebrate.
Listen, I'm good with it. I'm good with it. You know, back in the day, because, you know, everybody's talking about hair and afros. We weren't allowed to have an afro. My older brother was, but me and my other brother weren't. We weren't allowed to have an afro.
Oh, you weren't? All right, okay. Nah.
So people say, no, but you had curly perm. No, skiffle. Skiffle head all the time. Listen, we used to go to my dad's friend, not even barbers, you know, my dad's friend who we grew up with back home, who used to, you know, they say, used to cut hair back home.
Yeah.
So we go to his house, 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my brother, we get shorn like sheep.
Yeah.
While they're talking about boxing, horse racing, and we come home, and my mom will be going, looking at our hair, saying, why did your dad get your hair cut so short? My dad wouldn't come home until 10 o'clock in the evening. Bearing in mind, he's still at the same man's house.
Mm.
So I'd go to bed on a Saturday night, knowing that I got to go to church on a Sunday, and I'm praying that my hair's going to grow.
Yeah.
And then I'm praying hard that I don't get barber's knocks on Monday that no one's going to notice. And of course they notice, because my head's skiffle.
Oh, dear.
Now I can't even grow a skiffle. So, you know what I mean? So...
And it's so funny, as you're talking there, it's like, it seems like your parents, you know, they just had their rules and that was that. This is what we go by and that was that. But then you must have broke free. Did you have a period where the fashion kicked in and a period where you really broke free? You know, what did that feel like when you just thought, you know what, I can live my life the way I want to live my life. I'm going to do what I want to do. How did that feel when you could break free from all of those kind of rules and regulations?
That only happened when I went to university.
Yeah.
Listen, I was in the civil service before I went to university.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was in the civil service, I was still sharing a room with my brother.
Oh, bless you.
I was head of my own office, my own department, still sharing a room with my brother.
Oh, gosh.
Only got my own bedroom when I went to university.
Yeah.
So even then, when I went to uni, it was like, I didn't have an afro. Mm. It was like, I was, see, because the whole mindset of keeping your hair short, I always kept it short anyway.
Yeah.
Right? So I never thought of luxing up or getting an afro or anything, or curly perm and straightening my hair. No, never crossed my mind.
Yeah. Just kept
so it. It's like, so everybody's on about, yeah, your hair and this and that. I'm like, you know what? It was hair yesterday, gone today.
Oh dear. Oh, I do love all that with regards to our hair and all the experimenting that people do. And all, you know, you talk to black men, black women, the journeys, there's like a life in it, isn't there? There's life within the hair, isn't it, after a while? There's a lot of life there.
Life in the hair. I mean, yeah, for a lot of them, except for me and my brother, it was a case of skiffle. Oh, freedom. Yeah, let me just go a little bit. Oh, it's getting a bit too much. Let me get it cut. Then it's like, your hair's kind of stopped growing, hasn't it, really?
Oh, bless
you. Funny, the hair stops growing on the head, but I can grow a beard in like 24 hours.
Yeah, that is interesting how that switches, you know, how that switch, that is funny, yeah. But it's just what you say, it's all about embracing you, being who you are, and loving that. Okay, friend, I want you to give me your favourite quote, one of your favourite quotes that have inspired you, the quotes that has inspired you.
Who can't hear must feel. That's the biggest one. That's, you know, the book of mum and dad. Who can't hear must feel.
And like, for some of my audience that may not be West Indian, just explain what that actually means.
Right. Well, when your parents basically tell you to do something, if you don't hear what they're saying, they're going to beat you. Who can't hear must feel.
Oh, dear. Oh, God.
And I still live by that. Because there's many times when, even when you don't listen to yourself, we know right from wrong.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know, whether it's a judgment call or even if it's a case of, oh, you know what, I fancy having some junk food today when I know my body really shouldn't take it.
Mm.
And you feel it, don't you? You know, you feel it the next day or whatever. Who can I hear must feel.
That's it. And I feel, you know what, it's so interesting, but that is interpreted in so many different ways, you know, because I think about it, because my mum would say that to me, but my mum never hit me. Yeah, she never did. I suppose I'm the youngest. But never did. And she'd say that sometimes. So then I suppose I interpreted it differently in terms of, you know, there's impact here. She'd say that and it's almost like, okay, there's a bit of a threat, but there's an impact here if you go too far. And She didn't need to hit me, do you know? Because you just knew, because the eyes and everything else, you know, the look and the, you know, you're going too far here. And you just pull back and you just know, you know? And so sometimes language is really important, isn't it, really? It could be seen now as negative, you know, in terms of how things is now with regards to, you know, you don't smack children, the way discipline is, and, you know, living in a society, that's not done. But there's an impact there in another way in terms of that intensity and you know, and that cultural, you know, you're going to feel, it's like karma, you're going to feel the energy of what you put out in the world. And that's how I like to interpret it, that saying, you know, because I think as it goes on, you can interpret it anyway, but you are going to feel the impact on what you put out.
Absolutely, which is why it's my favourite saying.
Yeah.
Because it's timeless.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Oh, James, thank you very much for coming on my show today.
And thank you for inviting me.
Lovely. Oh, it's brilliant. It's great having a chat with you, and it's great to dive deep with you and to get to know James on a deeper level. So I just want to say from Tony the Communication Doctor and from James Pogson, adios!
Goodbye!
One of my takeaways from this show, generally, is that I felt quite relaxed with James. I loved his connection with the storytelling and the connection with reading the encyclopedia as a child, connecting to the Bible, and also from an early age, he had to find this resilience as a black man to kind of cope in the world. And I feel that he explained that so well in terms of it was just, you know, you have to find it, you know. And it was interesting talking about mental health as well from the other perspective of there are people out there that don't find that resilience. So I think that's what we need to remember when we look at all situations. Actually, we're brought up, some people are brought up to be that resilient, but not everybody can withstand all of that pain. But coming to the end of that, what's beautiful is just celebrating himself as a man and as a black man and as James, and celebrating all the beautiful things that he brings to the table. And I think that's important for men to do just generally, is celebrate themselves, men and women, just celebrate who you are and be okay with who you are. I feel that's one of the best things that you can do in life. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe. Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.